It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 234, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, Apple's new Macs and Minis, perplexing conundrums with Perplexity.ai, and social media misinformation.
Hey, Gary. So I understand that there's some new Apple stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting week. This is the second time Apple has done this. Actually, I think maybe the third, but this time they've like really upped it a notch. Instead of doing a big announcement on like one day and having a keynote event, they're instead having a week of new stuff. And they've done this in the past, and some of the stuff's been kind of tiny, like little updates and stuff. But this time it's big things, certainly worthy of a big like announcement, but said they're spreading it out. So we are recording this now late on Tuesday. So we don't yet know what Wednesday morning will bring, except that we absolutely do know what Wednesday morning will bring. Monday morning was a new iMac. Tuesday morning was the new Mac Mini, which is maybe the most interesting thing of the week. And then Wednesday morning will certainly be new MacBook Pros. In addition, on Monday morning, they also released macOS 15.1, iOS 18.1, and iPadOS 18.1, and some other operating systems as well. But the most notable thing about that, and that's a good place to start really, is that's the first versions of those operating systems to have actual Apple Intelligence features. So Apple Intelligence has begun its rollout. And
how intelligent is it?
It's pretty good, and it's pretty like what you would expect. I mean, obviously Apple's not hiding anything. They've had betas and things, and people have been talking about it. So the first features are basically reading and kind of writing features, but in terms of like rewriting and proofreading and things. Okay. So you can select stuff and say, summarize this for me. There's a bunch of stuff for that. Summarize stuff as lists, summarize, you know, make it, you know, give me one paragraph that explains this entire article, that kind of thing. The proofreading tool is an AI proofreading tool, which is different than what Apple has had for a long time, which has been a more algorithmic proofreading tool. Right. This is, you know, we'll find mistakes in your writing. And then there's the rewriting tool, which you can pick from just some basic things like rewrite this as friendly, rewrite this as, you know, professional, that kind of thing. And it rewrites your text for you. And it makes it available basically system-wide. You know, you can select the text, use the context menu or buttons, and it just changes the text right there in place.
I'm curious. I think we've talked about Grammarly and Pro Writing Aid in the past.
Yeah.
You have any sense of how this relates to that? Because this sounds like those tools.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically, I don't use Grammarly or, you know, any tools like that, but my sense is that you probably don't need those anymore. It's very much like that. Okay. I do happen to know because they also released the beta of the next version of things, right? Okay. So the beta testers are one version ahead. And in the next version, instead of just the buttons for like rewrite, rewrite friendly, rewrite professional, rewrite concise, they're the four options. The next version actually gives you a prompt. Like you could choose those four options, but you could also type what you want. So you can type something like professional and concise, or you know, some other thing like as a sonnet, and it will rewrite your application for a job as a sonnet.
Professional as a pirate, yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it'll do stuff like that. That's the next version. But yeah, so it's a very useful tool for people. It will be one of these things where there are people that use other tools now that will start using this. There'll be some people that don't use a tool now that will start using this. And there'll be people that don't use any tool now and write horribly, that continue to write horribly and not use this tool. I mean, we know that. You just have to look at Reddit and see all the spelling mistakes and think, spell check has been around since the 80s. Why are there posts every day at Reddit that are, you know, not spell checked? But yeah, so we have all that stuff now. We have like, and it's, you know, it's like in system settings now for all of these. There's Apple Intelligence, you can turn it on, that kind of thing. So you've got the basics there. And the next versions of all the operating systems coming out in December will have the first image generation tools.
Wow.
So that will be interesting. You do have one image editing tool now. If you have Apple Intelligence on your Mac, you Now, instead of having the old retouch tool, which much like the old grammar tool was algorithmic, this one's now using AI. So you can go into an image and erase your ex-girlfriend from it, that kind of thing. And it does it with AI in a similar way that you might, feed it to like a, another AI tool and ask it to make changes or use
Right,
Photoshop, for instance.
any of the several online tools, and yeah,
Yeah.
Photoshop with its AI capabilities now too.
And it's it's so that's really useful. Just having it there, just built in, is kind of nice. There, and a few other minor things, because it is a 0.1 release, so it's not like the major stuff. But there's a few other minor things in there. One of the things I like a lot is a new tool that, well, you can record phone calls on your iPhone, which is kind of nice. It's just built in to the, the phone app. There's just, you're talking to somebody, there's a button there, you can hit it, and it's really smart because if you hit it and say, yes, I want to record this call, the other person hears a little, this call is now being recorded thing, right? So you
Okay.
can't get away with secretly recording somebody.
Right.
And it will record it and give you a transcript.
Right.
It also takes you into the Notes app. So you can basically use this like, oh, say you're on an important phone call. And you say, oh, okay, I want to record this. I want to make sure I get this. It takes you into the Notes app. It shows it's being recorded. And now you're in the Notes app and you can actually take notes while you're talking to somebody. And then when the phone call's done or you hit stop recording, the recording's complete. And then after seconds, or maybe a minute or two if it's long, you'll get the transcript there, which is kind of nice. And that's a new feature in iOS 18.1. There's yeah, so it's, things like that. It's kind of neat, some neat things they've thrown in here. It's Apple moving away, I think, from the big annual releases because it used to be, maybe as little as like 4 or 5 years ago, that if it wasn't in the big release of the new operating system, it was not going to be added as a feature until next year. All that would happen is there would be minor changes and bug fixes until then. Now you've got this thing where Apple's like, here's the big one, and we're going to have more stuff in point one and more stuff in point two. And I really feel they're setting the stage for spreading it out and not having like big new operating system releases every year. So,
I wonder how much of that is related to the fact that the AI work is so massive, and
yeah.
that rather trying to just bundle it up into one large release, they've decided to do it this way, which obviously, I mean, makes a whole lot of sense.
Oh, I
And
think
they.
so. I think definitely. And it's there's you know there's it annual releases had its use, and for a while, and I don't think it's as necessary anymore. And it's probably would end up. It's to the point now where like the benefits of just year round coming out with new features, is better than the having this big, thing where it's like we can make all these announcements and all this stuff. So that's just the software. The hardware stuff, because this week's really about hardware, is we got new iMac on Monday, and the main thing is it uses the new M4 processor, so the latest processor, but the base level of the latest processor. This was to be expected. It's a nice upgrade. It comes with a bunch of neat things. One is an ample number of ports, and the support for two additional screens, which is really nice. Apple's kind of now moved with all the new models beyond the, oh, this the additional screens you can add are limited. Like all the new models seem to support plenty of screens. Like if you really want 4 or 5 screens, maybe, but that's not the majority of voices. It was the original machines only being able to do one or two screens that had people worried about it. But now all the new ones are like that. And 16 gigs of RAM is now Apple's standard base.
Good.
So this is a big new change because 8 gigs has been the base model for a long time. But 16 gigs is now the base model on the basic iMac, the $1,299 iMac, comes with 16 gigs of RAM. So that's neat. But besides that, the iMac looks the same. However, that's not true for what happened on Tuesday morning, which was the release of the new Mac Mini. And just as we've talked about here and was predicted, it's a whole new size. The Mac Mini is now 5 inches by 5 inches and 2 inches high.
I'm looking at the pictures on
It's,
apple.com and it's
yeah.
incredibly small.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's exactly what people were excited about. So Apple produced here, and then Apple produced a ton of ports on it. So you've got three Thunderbolt ports on the back, two USB ports on the front, Ethernet, HDMI as well, and a headphone jack. So you have, audio. You don't have to use a USB port for audio out.
What I find fascinating about the port situation is that it looks like there's no wall wart or transformer involved. You're actually plugging the line voltage directly into the box, which is great. I love it. But usually that implies a fair amount of circuitry to convert that into the internal voltages.
Yep, and the Apple TVs for a while now have been like that. So Apple has definitely mastered that part of it, the power supply part of it, and they incorporated that into this model here. And the Mac Minis too, but I can't remember. The Mac Minis I think originally did have external power converter, but at some point it moved internal. So they didn't want to go back to that. It's a really nice looking little computer, but it's also packs a lot of power because it's got the same M4 processor that the iMac has, but also the option to go up to the M4 Pro. So you've got more cores of every kind, CPU, GPU, neural, and all that. So that's really nice. That makes it takes it up to more, like literally more of a pro level you could get. And the Pro, if you get the M4 Pro, the surprise is that the M4 Pro supports not Thunderbolt 4, but Thunderbolt 5. So it's, I think it's 120 gigabits throughput or something. It's pretty impressive. So yeah, we have Thunderbolt 5 on those, on only the M4 Pro ones, which is nice. And the base RAM again is 16 gigs of RAM, which is nice. They still on both the iMac and the Mac Mini, they still offer a 256 gig storage option that is their base model. And I have mixed feelings about this because first, I would tell anybody to not get that. At minimum, get the 512. But just based on 15 years of hearing people run into trouble when they get the base amount of storage, thinking, I don't need it, or I'll get an external drive, and finding out all the problems. Like, they actually do need it because they don't need it now, but 5 years from now, they still have that computer and they need the storage and there's no way to upgrade. Or they find out the external drives, they look cheap. They're like, oh, I won't spend $200 more on storage because I can get like a $75 external drive. Except that $75 external drive is considerably slower than the internal. So then they're like, well, okay, I'll get this $200 external. Well, you could have gotten, an internal one for that. So I think on the one hand, it's like I advise any normal user, don't get the 512, don't get the 256, get 512 or 1 terabyte. On the other hand, I'm still glad Apple offers it because there are some uses for it. Like, for instance, if you're a school or school district buying a bunch of computers that go onto carts or sit on desks, these aren't personally owned computers. They're not going to be filled with photos and videos and apps and games and
All the random
music,
stuff, yes.
yeah, and TV shows downloaded and all the stuff that fills up drives. Those type of computers don't really need that much because they don't, they're meant to be basically bare bones in terms of the software. And though, so Apple should be offering a 256 gig version for those. And it's not like, that's like a minor thing because school districts could be buying hundreds of these. So being forced to buy a 512 gig storage when they don't need it, that's a lot of money. Also, other uses, anytime it's not your computer, like think of like offices that have, might be buying some iMacs or Mac Minis for various different purposes where it's not the person's personal computer. They're not going to have the Photos app filled with stuff. They're not going to be downloading stuff on Apple TV and all that. That type of device need there is a good use case for it. I almost wish Apple would say, hey, the base model is 512 gigabytes. But we do have like special like corporate and educational sales programs
All
where they
right.
could buy a lower level of it, Because sometimes I feel like people complain and say, Oh, they shouldn't offer 256 gigs as the base. And I'm like, okay, here's the deal. Pretend they don't. Don't buy
Right.
the $599 one. Pretend that
Right.
doesn't exist. The
Right.
$799 one is the base model, you know. So there's that. But anyway, the Mac Mini is really pretty cool. It's a pretty cool looking device. It can support three screens.
Okay.
And even the base one can support three screens. The M4 Pro can support three 6K screens, which is Apple's, you know, biggest display,
Right.
which is pretty impressive to get a machine. I think it's 12 or 13.99 is the M4 Pro, and it comes with like 16 or 24 gigs of RAM and half a
13.99.
terabyte.
I've got it on my
Yeah.
screen right now.
And the fact that you could run three 6K screens off of that,
What I'm curious
pretty
about is
neat.
could you run three 6K screens running three 6K videos
Yeah,
simultaneously?
you could. I mean, that's what it's, you know, that's the throughput of all of the video is to run those three 6K screens at full speed, you know. So, you know, technically you could do it. I don't know, you know, you start editing video on a Mac Mini, you know, it's probably going to do fine.
Yeah.
I'm often amazed, you know, because the whole debate of like 8 gigs of RAM is not enough. And I'm following the, you know, the threads on 8 gigs of RAM is not enough on my 8 gigs of RAM MacBook Air. And it occurs to me, it's like I have a unique perspective in that I've got a 64 gig Mac Studio on my desk, right? That's got the M4 Ultra or the M1 Ultra and 64 gigs of RAM on my desk that I use for things all the time. My MacBook Air is an M2. With it's a base M2 with 8 gigs of RAM, and I don't hold back when I use the MacBook Air. Like I don't sit and think, oh, I shouldn't launch Final Cut Pro, or oh, I shouldn't try to do this, and this at the same time because I'm not on my desktop computer. I just kind of forget, and I just do it, and then I'm trying to think, well, okay, but has that led me into any trouble? No. No, it hasn't. You know, I haven't run into any situations where it's like, oh, hey, the computer's slowing down. Oh, that's right. I'm on my little MacBook Air. That's why. No, it just seems to handle what I throw at it, which makes me question why I need a 64 gigs of RAM on my Mac Studio. And probably, I mean, maybe if I was producing Hollywood films, you know, at 8K,
The only
and Final Cut
scenario that
Pro, yeah.
makes a lot of sense for you, and it's the scenario that I used to justify putting 64 gig in my PC, is virtual machines. I don't know if you're running any
Yeah.
virtual machines at all, but
Mm,
that's a
kind of.
great way to be able to support multiple virtual machines, even while you're doing video editing. So, yeah.
I actually, so I don't do virtual machines much. I've just experimented with them for the sake of experimenting with them. So I'm not really doing it because actually, Mac OS, the current version of Mac OS and the Apple Silicon processors handle virtual machines really well. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there to let them do that.
Right.
So there are like apps that are super lightweight apps that just tap into the system's ability of virtualization and just to let you like boot up another Mac inside a window, or you know, some flavor of Linux. And I've experimented with that. I do, however, do something a little bit different. I use an app called Whiskey, which I believe is a wrapper kind of for using Wine to wrap Windows apps, usually
Okay.
games.
Yep.
And so I'm not really running Windows, but I am running Windows apps using Wine through Whiskey to give them all the functionality that they need and allow me to play a Windows game. And on my Mac Studio, it runs great. I haven't tried it on a MacBook Air. It's not like it's easy to just port that whole thing over. And I want to play these games on the big screen. And the funny thing is, I'm playing a game that, on the one hand, would seem to be like, oh, that's not a good test. But on the other hand, it's actually an excellent test. Dwarf Fortress, right? That game, which is like, you know, a lot of people still think of it as a game that's ASCII characters on the screen.
Right.
2D ASCII characters. The current Windows version is not 2D ASCII characters. They've upgraded from that 1970s look to more of a 1990s tile-based look. It still looks pretty primitive, but the weird thing is, of course, running under the hood, it's intensely power, like it's using a ton of processor power
Right.
because it's doing the thing where every little thing, like including like a little cat running around on the screen, grazing in a field, is like running a complex set of algorithms to determine what it does.
Right,
And you
right.
have like thousands of them happening at the same time. So it's extremely processor intensive. And I'm doing that on my Mac through wine, through whiskey. Yeah, it's a whole thing. Anyway, so
So what's coming up tomorrow
coming up
or
tomorrow is
yeah.
MacBook Pros. I mean, everybody knows
Okay.
that. So it's going to be the M4 MacBook Pros. And the reason Apple probably did it this way is they already had the M4 processors out before, but introducing the iMac with the M4 processor made sense. So new iMac, same processor. Then they come out with the Mac Mini and say, oh, guess what? There's an M4 Pro processor, right?
Right.
So introduction of that. And tomorrow, the MacBook Pros, they'll say, hey, you've got the M4 Pro processor and the M4 Max
Max.
processor.
Yep. I was wondering if that's what would end up
Yeah,
happening.
it's, that's what they'll do. And then the question is will they, when will they introduce a Mac Studio with an M4 Ultra? Probably not this week. It'll probably be next, in the spring or something.
Right.
Yeah,
And do
so
they have
tomorrow
things
we'll get, what was
planned
that?
for Thursday? Do they have things planned for Thursday and Friday?
I don't think so. Every time they've done this, it's been Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday with some extra, maybe
Okay.
with something. But I get the feeling it's just Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but who knows? We will find out tomorrow morning because Monday and Tuesday, they've said they've ended their little thing with, because they've been producing a video every morning. So they are
Right.
actually doing like keynote events, but in 10-minute bits. So Monday and Tuesday, they've said more to come.
Okay.
So if Wednesday morning they introduce, here's the MacBook Pro, and at the end they say more to come, then we know. And if they don't, it's like, okay, we're done. So we'll probably get no new design or anything like that. We'll just get new processors, probably the Thunderbolt 5 ports. And we'll see if there's anything else that's cool, like a, possibly, I don't know, maybe more ports, maybe who knows. But they might throw in a little bit, little some screen stuff they're always throwing in, like, oh, it goes down to less nits or more nits or whatever. There are some other footnotes. One of the interesting things that they came out with Monday was they said they came out with new keyboards. So the old keyboards still were like they were the last devices almost that Apple still had lightning ports on for charging and for connecting to your Mac if you wanted to not run them wirelessly. And people have been speculating that they would upgrade to USB-C on those. And they did. But for me, an interesting thing, and the one thing I actually did order, is Apple makes two keyboards, the regular keyboard, which just basically goes across from, the caps lock to the return key, a narrow keyboard. And then the extended, they used to call it the extended keyboard. Now they call it the keyboard with the numeric keypad,
Right.
which has the numeric keypad on the right and a bunch of keys in the middle and arrow keys and stuff like that. I always use that because I've got lots of like macros and things that I map to those keys on the numeric keypad. So the numeric keypad for me is kind of like one of those little Stream Decks. It's all these extra buttons that
Right. Yep. Yep.
I could map to cool things for video editing and stuff. So I've stuck with it, but that means I haven't been able to get I haven't been able to, I could have gotten one with a Touch ID, which I really want, but I was kind of waiting for them to upgrade to USB-C to get that as well. Plus, it's always bugged me that as Apple has increased the importance of the FN, or as it's known now, the globe key, which is like a modifier key on Macs that has a globe on it now, used to have FN on it, and in
Right.
the middle, it sometimes had both. The FN key has always been on these extended keyboards in the middle section, like with the home and page up and page down. But as Apple uses it more and more, it's a very awkward spot. You've got your modifier keys at the bottom of your keyboard surrounding the space bar. And then you have this FN key in a completely awkward space. So they've moved it to the lower left-hand corner, and it's been on the MacBook Pros, it's been there for years. On the smaller keyboard, it's been there for a while. But on this extended numeric keypad keyboard, they've kept it in this awkward spot. Well, the new one that just came out, it's got Touch ID, it's got the FN key at the lower left, and it's USB-C, sold, ordered immediately. And I can't wait to get that. And the main feature I want is Touch ID, because I switch between user accounts constantly to do tutorials. And most people don't notice the Touch ID thing because they have an Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch will authenticate for you. So to log into my regular account, my Apple Watch just does it because I'm wearing it and I'm logged into my Apple Watch. But to go to my tutorial account, that's not the Apple ID of my Apple Watch. So I actually have to type my password in every single time.
Oh, how horrible.
I know. Well, but it's, I've got a fairly good password because, I practice what I preach. It's not dog's name, it's a real password. So having Touch ID like I do on my MacBook Air, and it's going to be great. So I can't wait to get that. That arrives the end of the week. Looking forward to that. Looking forward to see if Apple announces anything else. But I doubt it. I think this will hold them pretty good. They did announce last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, and the new iPad mini, which I'm wondering why they didn't hold that. I guess they wanted to get that out for holiday sales. I don't know. But
Probably, yeah.
the new iPad mini's out, and that's and I'm actually an iPad mini user. I've got the sixth generation iPad mini. I haven't jumped onto the seventh gen because, sixth gen's fine. I really don't use it for like Apple Intelligence kinds of things. I mostly use it to watch videos, maybe play a few games. It's not like a machine I actually do work on. So I need an iPad around for iPad-y things, but I don't necessarily need the latest and greatest anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta say, I was looking at the Mac Mini, and man, if I were in the market, that is really, really tempting.
Yeah.
Just 'cause. But of course, the only the thing I was thinking of as I was, drooling over it is, okay, so tomorrow there's going to be MacBook Pros. I wonder how many people will order a Mac Mini today and then regret it tomorrow,
I don't
right?
know. I mean, they're very different price levels. The Mac Mini competes more with the MacBook Air in those kind of prices. The
Sure.
MacBook Pros, a lot of people get sticker shock when they forget things like the fact that MacBook Pros are expensive. MacBook Airs are not, right? So you end up with this thing. It's like, oh, I'd like a MacBook Air's nice, but let me get the MacBook Pro. And then you realize, oh, that's $1,000 more.
Right.
But it's the same thing when Apple used to have two iMacs, and you'd have people that would say, oh, this is a cool looking iMac, something like the base level, smaller screen one. Oh, but I hear they're going to introduce, the new higher level iMac, and then be like, oh, it's $4,000. Yeah, because it had like Intel Xeon processors in it and all sorts of stuff.
All the good stuff, yeah.
And it's the same thing with the MacBook Pros. There are going to be plenty of people that'll be like, cool, they're finally out. I can buy a new MacBook. Oh, look at that price. So the MacBook Air, what's the deal with that again? And they'll go back to Apple will probably sell a lot of MacBook Airs tomorrow after people see the MacBook Pro, realize that they can't afford it. And they probably should have bought a MacBook Air when the last ones came out anyway.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, so I did comment on social media today. This is the first time in a while where every single Mac model that's current production, I want. Like, I don't need them, but I want them.
Right. I
Like
know the feeling. Yeah.
previously, there's been ones that are like, oh wow, yeah, the iMac looks so cool. I wish I had a use for it. I'd buy it. But then the Mac Mini is like, well, I've got a Mac Studio, so why would I want a Mac Mini? Like, I don't want it. But now it's like, oh, the Mac Mini is so cool. It's so small, neat. I actually want it now, even though I do have a Mac Studio, but I have no need for it. I won't be buying anything. But it's like, yeah, that's true of everything from the Mac Mini, all the other Macs, in the MacBooks, all the way to the Mac Pro. It's like, I want them all. They have green
Honestly,
check marks in that column. I just don't need them.
that's just our lot in life, given
Yeah.
what we do. We are always going to be encountering wonderful products that we would love to have, that we are lusting after, that there's absolutely no way we could justify buying.
Yeah, I mean, how many do I need? It's like,
Yep.
yeah. So, but here we
Cool. Well,
go.
it's been a good couple of days for you then. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, switching topics, but not really, since AI is such a common thread these days. I wanted to get your reaction to this because over the last, I'll just say a couple of weeks, I have been using Perplexity.ai. Essentially, I'm reluctant to even call it a search engine anymore. It's more of, I guess, an answer engine. The bottom line is I'm throwing all sorts of just random stuff at Perplexity, and it's figuring it out and actually giving me incredibly useful information the first time out. I've been asking it to interpret error messages. I've been asking it to give me steps to do certain things, and it just does. I've been asking it, is this and this a thing possible? And it says, yes, it is, and here's how you do it, which is great, wonderful. Except, am I shooting myself in the foot? Because Perplexity, along with others, I mean, this is not necessarily a new topic, but Perplexity is making it very, very lucrative. Where do they get their answers from? Well, from sites like yours and mine, and Reddit, and of course, all sorts of other places. But I in part of me feels guilty because I'm not clicking through to the sites that are actually producing the information, even though Perplexity does a very good job of including reference links. So if I wanted to see where an answer came from, I could. But given that the answer is right there on the screen and it's almost always right, why would I? And yet I understand that that is in a way harming the very same ecosystem that allows Perplexity to do what it's doing. And I don't know what to make of it. I feel bad, and yet I keep doing it because it's so darned efficient. I'm curious if you've had any thoughts along those lines in your travels on the search engines and the answer engines and such.
Oh, definitely. It's something I think about a lot. If we can get answers from AI, which is taking its information from previous human-generated answers, then there'll be no new answers being created. So at some point, our knowledge stops. Like, is 2024 or 2025 maybe the year that everything kind of stagnates, and for the next however many years, our information's the same, right? Nobody's writing new stuff. Nobody's
Based on
researching new
research
stuff.
data through AI, yes.
Yeah, and I think though that's strangely, I think it's something that's come to the surface that was before kind of unseen. Like if you look at lots of creative endeavors, there are periods of innovation and then periods of stagnation. And then a lot of times during those periods of stagnation, people think it's over. Like this is settled. Like I even thinking of the times when different sciences over the years, there were periods of decades sometimes in different sciences where they thought we've completed the science.
We're done.
Like geology thought we're done, right? At a time before, I think before plate tectonics was discovered, they were like, we're done. We know everything there is to know about rocks. And somebody was like, oh, the Earth's surface may be moving. So we actually only knew 1% of geology. There's physics. Like there was a time, before relativity, when it was like, well, I think we figured it all out.
Vaguely recall a patent office official saying that they'd effectively issued the last patent because there wasn't anything more to be invented.
There's stuff like that, and it's happened in creative pursuits too. I mean, if you look at like film, there are like periods where filmmakers go through. It's like, well, film has reached its apex. Then there's like 10 years of movies that aren't really bringing anything new to the table. And then a bunch of new young directors come in and start doing things that people didn't imagine. And then suddenly there's this period of innovation and things change. And then it settles down again and becomes stagnant. And I think probably other types of arts too, and writing and everything, it ha there are these cycles. And I'm wondering if AI for things like writing or creating knowledge or something on the internet, like if it's signaling the end of a innovation that started in the late 90s with blogging, right, and continued through to today, but has had plenty of signs of dying off before AI, like of stagnating. Like so many blogs. I mean, there was a period, God, around 2010, 20 to 2014, when like there were like massive blogging sites and they were coming together and merging, and there's tons of money being thrown in it. And like journalism seemed like the future of journalism was all just going to be these websites that were like blogs and stuff. And then they all kind of died out really quickly. And you know, it just seems like, okay, so we've gotten to a point now where we might be hitting a period of stagnation, and AI is part of that. And we don't really have too much that's innovative in terms of people creating content on the internet. But history then points to the fact that we're wrong, and that maybe, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we hit a point where AI can't really predict, you know, like AI is still there, but then people figure out, okay, based on that, here's like a whole new direction we can go that doesn't involve AI in terms of creativity. And so I don't know. I'm not all doom and gloom,
Right. Well,
and
neither am I. I mean,
yeah.
clearly, by bringing this up, I'm more like guilt,
Guilt, yes.
and like the way I rephrased it in my notes is like it's an existential dilemma because Ask Leo depends on people not behaving the way that I'm behaving, and I'm just not sure what that means long term. But you're right. I mean, there absolutely will be stair steps to the pro to things progressing, but we're in the here and now, and I want to make sure that I understand what I'm doing with full knowledge and doing the quote unquote right thing. It's funny because the kinds of things I'm doing with Perplexity, the reaction will be, well, don't use Perplexity, use traditional search engines and go to sites and so forth. The problem is where AI is really adding value is it is synthesizing way more information than I would be able to find in a search and coalescing it into a statement or into a solution. Just takes all of the information, puts it in appropriate way that I can understand what's going on. That would take me days of searching. And as a result, I'm saving oodles of time by using this instead of doing it, the old-fashioned way, so to speak. But
No,
it's a
I use
dilemma.
it. I use Perplexity here and there, and I use ChatGPT and Claude as well. I mean, I find myself doing things just the other day, or just the other day, just this morning. I just couldn't find the right phrase for something. Like, oh, there's a better way to say this when I
Yes,
was writing something,
I've done that.
and it's kind of a thesaurus thing, but it's not a single word. It's like, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I could start. If I'd started a Google search, I could probably in a few minutes figure this out. Or I could just type a bunch of stuff into ChatGPT. Like, just, I don't even have to be very precise.
Yes.
Like, here's what I've said. I think there's a better way to say something similar. Not sure. Return. And it spat back exactly. Oh, yeah, that was it. And I was like, that took me 15 seconds.
Exactly.
I think it's, you know, we have to use these tools that are there. I don't know. It's good that we're thinking about it, right?
Yeah. Oh,
We're
absolutely.
thinking about it all the time and thinking maybe is this the best way to do it? My dream is, of course, to as I continue to produce content and like 4,000 transcripts worth of MacMost videos, is that I could train a large language model on me, produce a chatbot that is, you know, Gary GPT.
Gary Bot.
And then the thing would be to do is have it answer people's questions. And first of all, have a little side channel where it's like, hey, answer people's questions for me. But if you have trouble, if you sense that you're not communicating well with the person, let me know what the question was. And then also have the person at the end say, hey, was this a good answer? And give it a thumbs up or thumbs down. And then compile that information. And over time, let me know like what questions were able to handle well. And
Right.
like what was your top thing that you had trouble with recently? And then I produce a completely new piece of content based on that.
Right.
It's the same as having an assistant. Like if you have that assistant go and do stuff and say any questions you have trouble with, let me know. And those would be good topics for videos. I need you need the AI to do that also. But maybe that's circular, like to your thing. Like I would just be completing the AI until it got so good it didn't need me for
Need you
anything.
anymore. Yep.
But
Yep.
yeah, but and you know what? Then I'd be challenged to be like, well, what can I do that the AI can't do?
Well, the good news about our industry, of course, is that it's always growing, it's always changing, right? The AI, for example, doesn't have a ton of content to consume about, say, the latest version of Mac OS or the latest, piece of Mac hardware. You're generating that content will end up feeding the AI, but for that little window, right? You are, you're the expert, not the AI. But yeah,
And it
it's I don't know, it's tough. And absolutely, I use AI for a lot of different things. The only thing I don't use it for, honestly, is to generate text. I use it to generate images, and I use it to help me write better text. Those are things that are transforming content that I am personally working on, as opposed to returning the information based on content. And it's a challenge. Anyway, so Perplexity, it is perplexing. Now, I ran across an article actually just this morning, I think. The article's title is "The Newest." Let's see, this is different. Well, they changed it. "The Newest AI Slop on Facebook Exploits Suburban Fear." Basically, are a series of images of people claiming that, quote, "My neighbor threw eggs at my car because it blocked the view of his Halloween decorations." And these are pictures of a car just covered in like three or four, five, six dozen eggs that have been plastered on it. Here's the thing. None of it is real. The images are AI generated. And in fact, if you look at multiple images, you'll see it's often a very similar looking car, even though it's in different situations, different settings. And it is being used by a bunch of essentially bot accounts, I guess. It's very bizarre. It's very difficult to understand. But the one thing it is doing is it's acting as rage bait. And people are responding to this like nobody's business. They're either saying, how could they do this? Or couldn't the eggs have gone to a better use? Or, there are people hungry, all that kind of stuff. I just found this fascinating. Not for what it is, because this will happen and there'll be variations on it and so forth. But what it really boils down to, and it's something that, gosh, I've been preaching to people for a long time, and I think you have too, we have to be even more skeptical in an AI-based world because it is becoming more and more, I don't want to say difficult, because it is absolutely possible to relatively quickly figure out that this isn't what it seems to be. But you gotta make the effort. You gotta assume the worst, especially for things that are rage bait, things that are that really generate an emotional response in you. That's kind of like the huge flag on social media that says, you know what? If I'm feeling this strongly about something, let's make sure it's a thing first, right? And yet, in the moment, people aren't doing that. And I think that that's what, if there's one thing that people really need to become accustomed to and learn how to do better, is just be more skeptical. Before you throw that ranty comment on a post, make sure that whatever you're commenting on actually happened. So I don't know. It's tough. I'm sure you've seen exactly the same kind of stuff in your travels.
Oh, sure. I'm not on the two biggest social media networks anymore, but I am on a lot of the smaller ones. They have various degrees of like this kind of thing happening. I think one of the main things is I wish people would hold back with the reposting or liking of posts more. Like we need to, I mean, if you see something and it gives you an emotional response, you don't have to hit the like button or hit the share button. Like it's okay. Like people are like, oh, you're telling me I have to, if I see something, I need to research it and figure out if it's true. No, you don't. You could just ignore it. Like you
Oh.
don't have to do any of this, right? If you see something and you're like, I'm not sure this is true, which you should be saying a lot of the time, you could just go and say, you know what? I don't have the time to research this. I'm not going to share it. I'm not going to like it. I'm not going to comment on it. I'm not going to perpetuate the spread of this thing. Maybe save that for the things that are like closest to you, that maybe you know something about,
Right.
that your particular expertise or your particular hobby or whatever it is, and say, I'm going to, my thing is this. I'm passionate about public transportation. So if somebody posts something about public transportation, then I will take the time to figure out if this is true or not
It
and
doesn't
comment
even
on it
have
or
to be
whatever,
social issues like that. I mean, honestly, if your car, if you woke up one morning and found a couple dozen eggs on your car, absolutely, post it, talk about it, do whatever. There's a if something is happening local to you, for example, this last weekend, I think it was just Sunday, there was a mudslide in Bellingham, north of here, and there's lots of interesting pictures and all sorts of commentary on it. That's local. That's news. That's real. You can see it. In fact, I had a niece who literally walked over to it and took some pictures because she was nearby. Those are the kinds of things that, well, yeah, of course, talk about those all you want. Like, share, whatever it makes sense. It's this stuff that I don't know. I don't
It's
know.
too easy. It's too easy to, maybe it should be the kind of thing where social media networks could be more responsible by limiting the amount of interactions. Like, wouldn't it be neat if you got, 5 likes a week? You
Oh, I was
could,
going to go for a day, but sure.
only comment like once a day. And that kind of thing, and only share one thing a day or whatever. You had a limited number, and it displayed them at the top. So you really had to think. You couldn't just be liking everything, and then it's then sent to all your friends.
And what would be so cool is that a like would be
Scarcity.
so much more valuable.
Yeah, it would be, and it would create
People
the
give it.
scarcity. It would get you thinking about it, right?
All right.
Because you have to really think, do I really want to hit the like button because this is like worth something now? That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a great idea. You know what that means?
Yeah, it
Never
won't
gonna
happen.
happen. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Some of these other social media networks, Blue Sky, Mastodon, it sounds like the kind of thing that somebody might want to try. They would probably try to monetize it, though. Like, that would be my fear, is I'd say, that's great. And you could buy more likes.
Buy more likes, exactly.
And then it's like, no, because then people are going to be like throwing all their money at this just to be able to get more influence.
Only the rich can like, yes.
Only the rich guy. It sounds like an episode of
Anyway,
Black Mirror right there.
be skeptical.
Oh, and I just wanted to, one last thing. I think did we talk about this last week about how, archive.org podcast and all that. So I pulled the trigger. I think last week I left off like I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I pulled the trigger on it. My video podcast is no more. Okay. So, just a quick recap. Since 2007, Macmost had a video podcast feed. Matter of fact, that was its main distribution channel originally. That's become less and less important in the, with YouTube becoming bigger, my site, my email newsletter, and all of that. Only a few hundred people were getting my video podcast feed. Most of those were probably people not watching it. It was just getting automatically downloaded because that's what podcast apps do. It didn't cost me much of anything because I just hosted all the videos at archive.org. I was uploading them there anyway for posterity, so I just linked the podcast feed to the video at archive.org. Archive.org went down, of course, and it still is down in some ways for this.
Yeah, I tried to
It's at
log in. I couldn't log in to
Yeah,
it.
you can't log in, so I can't upload new ones. I could link to old ones. They work if but I couldn't upload the new videos, so there was no way to actually include those. I tried giving them to Amazon in AWS, thinking, well, that's got to be one of the cheapest ways. An Amazon S3 bucket has to be one of the cheapest ways, and it still was going to cost hundreds of dollars
Yeah,
a
Amazon's not
month.
that cheap. Anything that has a an internet facing URL accessible solution is not going to be cheap.
So when I think I could maybe cut that considerably by going somewhere else, but then it gets hard to find something that does it in a way that works for podcasts. So it was proving to be difficult. I'm like, how many people actually use the podcast feed, and how many need to use it? Because nobody needs to use it anymore. You know, the videos are, if you want to watch the videos ad free, they're at my site ad free. If you want to watch them on YouTube, you can watch them on YouTube. YouTube sticks ads on them. So I was like, this is becoming a lot of trouble. And we're talking like 300 subscribers, and a fraction of those are actually real subscribers.
Paying attention.
When I'm looking at YouTube is 400,000 subscribers, and my newsletter is 35,000 subscribers. So spending all this time trying to figure this out for 300, probably more like 30, is like, this is ridiculous. So I replaced, first I tried to set the feed up with no video, and the podcast apps were like, oh, with no video, no post, right? It was like empty feed. So then I made a video that's 2 seconds long that just says, please watch the video at macmost.com, and just made that the video for every single post. But strangely, I got several. I did hear from four people at this point. Three out of the four were saying that they only got the first 2 seconds of the video. And I was like, no, that's not the first 2 seconds. The
The
two
whole video.
seconds, it says at the bottom in big white letters, go to the site. This isn't the video. And in the description, too, I say, go to the website. So I'll probably pretty soon, I mean, I've got the feed up there, but I think people are having trouble with it. I think some of the podcast apps are like, hey, this video is the same video for everyone, so it's not showing people the new episodes. Like, it might be using the episode, like the URL for the media as the identifier.
Oh,
And
right.
since
Yeah,
it's the
probably.
same, it's like confused. Anyway, so I'm probably just going to totally kill it. It's a shame, but it's also not a shame. I mean, it wasn't doing anything for me for a long time. And it also had the problem, or it had the benefit for a long time of being a discoverability thing. Somebody would go to Apple's iTunes app and look at podcasts and say, what podcasts are there? And then they'd find MacMost, and that's how they would discover MacMost. But when Apple moved from iTunes to a podcast app, they ignored video podcasts. And suddenly there wasn't a separate section for them. They were with the audio podcasts, but being video podcasts and so much larger and difficult, you can't watch them like if you're doing headphones on a bus or whatever. They just basically fell out of the top 100 or 200 for any category. So there's no discoverability. The only way to know that MacMost was a podcast was to search for MacMost, which is kind of defeats the point. Anyway, it's interesting. I've had a few people say they're disappointed. I said I've heard from four people at this point.
17 years. That's, pretty significant.
I
So.
know. And it's a shame. It's a shame. I did actually test out, did I mention last week? I tested out using Claude to take the transcript of the MacMost videos. So I had the transcript. I took the transcript. I gave it to Claude. I gave it a long prompt explaining that I want this to be an audio podcast, meaning that things could not be seen on the screen. So you may need to expand on what I'm saying to describe what's on the screen, right, because you can't see it, and make it into an audio podcast as a single person audio podcast. No, you know, not two people. And Claude produced an example that was good. I then took it to 11 Labs, took the voice I made, so the pro level voice that's Gary, and had Gary read it into an audio file. And I was like, this could be the podcast. It's like an audio version of my video podcast. It worked. It was great. I was all ready to go. And then I realized, to do this for real, I probably should read the transcript first before 11 Labs speaks it. And then I should probably listen to it afterwards to make sure it doesn't mispronounce some technical term and make me sound stupid. And then I realized I'm already spending way more time per episode than I was doing before.
Started to sound a lot
So,
of work, yes.
no, thanks. So anyway, there we go.
So, ain't it cool? Rivals. Have you heard of or seen Rivals?
No, I have not.
So Rivals is a series. I think, yes, they've had one season so far. It's all, I think, on Hulu. And there's no decision on a season two, but there's a lot of commentary that they better do one. Basically, it is, I don't know, just rich folk in the UK in the 1980s. The reason we started watching it is because David Tennant is in it. David Tennant, of course, being one of the Doctor Who's. And it's turning out to be a guilty pleasure. It is not necessarily what I would call Emmy, BAFTA, Oscar worthy stuff, but it is very well done, to be sure. It's just, the kind of rich person scandal stuff that you would expect in the UK in the 1980s. Anyway, we're just having fun with it. Didn't necessarily expect to. It was one of those cases where we, okay, this has got David Tennant in it. Let's watch an episode and see if we like it. And now we're like three or four episodes in.
Interesting.
Rivals.
My Ain't It Cool for the week is, if we had been doing this podcast for 25 years, 25 years ago, we probably would have been talking about The Tipping Point,
Yes.
which of course is a famous book by Malcolm Gladwell. And, he has written other books and done a lot of podcasts since. It's basically about sociology. He modernized sociology for non-sociologists, studies and interesting things about how people think and work and large groups. So he basically came out with a sequel to The Tipping Point 25 years later called Revenge of the Tipping Point. And most of his books have actually pretty much been sequels to The Tipping Point. I think he said I heard somewhere that he started out trying to update Tipping Point for a 25th anniversary and then came across all this new stuff and decided to write a whole new book. So he called it Revenge of the Tipping Point. It deals with some of the same stuff, interesting studies going back to the idea that, certain phenomena happen when you get enough people agreeing or disagreeing in some way. And it's fascinating to hear these different studies and different things that have happened over time. And his research into connecting things that seem to have very little to do with each other. At first, like I think a big theme running through is the whole opioid epidemic in the United States.
Interesting.
And then connecting that to things like, white flight, teen suicide, and cheetahs, the survival of cheetahs, and things like that, that seem kind of disconnected, but actually have some things in common that could be brought together to develop these kinds of rules. And I think a lot of the stuff from his original Tipping Point book, like some of the actual facts in it, have been disputed since then. And
Yes.
I've always hated the talk like that because I think the whole general gist of the Tipping Point is something that was very important. And to nitpick at, like, oh, well, technically, this thing, there was another study and blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but it got us to start thinking about things differently.
Right.
And this kind of continues that. It adds actually new things to it, like something called the overstory, which was interesting because it's like he looks into things like there was an epidemic of bank robberies and there was an epidemic of Medicare fraud. But the bank robberies mostly happened in Los Angeles, and the Medicare fraud mostly happened in Miami. Why? Because there's no difference in banks throughout the United States, and there's no difference in Medicare throughout the United States.
Right.
Why were these two places, like basically places where epidemics sprung up with huge numbers? And he kind of investigates that and ties that into some of these other things. Anyway, good read. I love these kinds of books, and I love hearing about these studies and interesting facts and stuff like that.
Cool. Self-promotion. So this week I'm going to do something a little bit different. There's an article that I posted called Ask Leo and Facebook. It actually didn't go out in my newsletter, although I did talk about it in the newsletter, and it didn't go out in its normal new article notifications. Basically, Facebook annoyed me one too many times. I mean, I've kind of been here before. The big issue is that I started having multiple cases of perfectly legitimate posts being taken down for some sort of policy violation where it was very clear there was no policy violation. It's basically Facebook's AI run amok. And I'm just getting tired of it. That coupled with the fact that, I've got, I don't know, 10,000 people who have liked the page, and any individual post is going to be seen by about 1% of them. It just doesn't make any sense. So I'm pulling back from Facebook's again. I've done, like I said, I've been here before, but hopefully, I assume this time it's going to stick a little bit longer. What's going to happen is, I'm still going to maintain a Facebook page, and I'm still going to be posting things there automatically. So if I've got, like, when I publish a new post on Ask Leo, it gets automatically picked up and posted to Facebook. That's going to continue. When I post something new, it's also now going to go out to a few other social medias that I'm going to try. For example, some things will go out to TikTok, some things will go to Threads, some things will go to Mastodon, some things will go to Instagram. There's probably one or two that I'm missing. Bottom line is that for a while at least, I'm going to be spreading some of my content a little bit wider to see if any of it actually engages on these platforms. The other thing you may have noticed, and this is kind of a sneak peek for podcast listeners because I haven't mentioned it to the regular audience yet, is that I have set up a second YouTube channel, YouTube Ask Leo Shorts. And I've been playing with a tool that lets me make actually very nice YouTube Shorts out of my existing videos. It uses, of course, it uses AI, but it does a really nice job of, isolating me on the screen and what I'm talking about and so forth. Anyway, I've been posting those not only to YouTube Shorts, but that's where a lot of the TikTok content is coming from. Anyway, that's going out everywhere. So that's something that people may be interested in. But be aware, if you're trying to reach me on Facebook, I'm probably not going to see it. If you want to reach me, of course, the best way is askleo.com. And the best way to stay in contact with all of it is to subscribe to my newsletter. But yeah, I'm playing with it. Anyway, so there's a link to the article where I talk about all this. And that article includes all the links to all the socials that I'm experimenting with.
Great. And we'll just plug my video on Mac OS Sequoia 15.1. What's new there? I've got a video on that.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, I think once again, we've done it again. We're done for another week. As always, thank you everybody for listening, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH234. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.